Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. And as a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Mary, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Program Treatment Update on GIST, on gastrointestinal stromal tumors. I know many of you have waited for this program for quite some time, and we are really delighted to be able to offer this program. Today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care, many cancer organizations, and many GIST organizations that have really allowed us to reach out to so many of you. And because of that, we have on the call today over 589 participants. And you come from all over the United States, from all different regions and parts of the country. We also have international participants from Algeria, Canada, India, Italy, Malaysia, Pakistan, the Philippines, United Arab Emirates, and the United Kingdom. So you really come from all over the world. And it's truly a credit that you've chosen to join us today for our call. You are clearly a group of information seekers. Today's program was made possible by an unrestricted educational grant from Novartis Oncology, and I really want to thank them for their support. Now, you receive materials from Cancer Care, and in those materials, there's lots of resources to you, all the different organizations that you can contact for additional help and information. There also is an evaluation form, and I would ask you each to take a moment at the end of today's program and complete that evaluation form. When you think about it, who but each of you can best tell us the programs you'd like us to offer moving forward? This is the beginning of a new year. We're planning lots of programs. We'd like to offer more programs that would be helpful to you that are really most relevant to meet your needs. Indeed, this particular program is based on your request to us to do a program on this topic. So please tell us what you want, and we'll try very hard to implement your suggestions. We have wonderful speakers on today's program. So I think we actually have the world's experts on GIST on the program today. And I want to start by introducing our first speaker, Dr. George Dimitri. Dr. Dimitri is Director, Ludwig Center at Dana-Farber, Harvard Cancer Center and Sarcoma Center, Quick Family Senior Investigator in Medical Oncology, Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. And Dr. Dimitri is going to start by providing an overview of GIST and a summary of the treatment of GIST. Dr. Dimitri?
Well, thank you very much, Carolyn, and let me extend my welcome as well to such a broad and diverse community of patients, family, and information seekers on this topic. The other members of the faculty, Dr. Wayne and Dr. Heinrich, and I have a deep and abiding commitment to this field, and it's nice to be able to reach out to people in somewhat non-conventional ways like this. It's almost a little bit strange that we should even give an overview of GIST to people who are listening, because almost certainly either you've been touched with GIST personally, or you have somebody in your family, or you know the area. So GIST has certainly come into its own as even a disease, as a diagnosed disease, only in the last 12 years. Before that, it was often misdiagnosed, and now it's rarely misdiagnosed. And so our pathologists have come a long way educating themselves about the ways to diagnose this disease. And something as simple as a diagnosis, most lay people might think, well, why is that so hard? And it's really because when you look at different kinds of cancer cells under the microscope, they can resemble each other. So there are other tools the pathologists use to make this diagnosis accurately, and that tool used to be something that look to see whether the cells under the microscope had a specific protein on its surface called KIT. And if it did, that was something that triggered their thought process to say, aha, maybe this is a GIST. That was 10 or 12 years ago already. These days, much more sophisticated DNA-type testing is starting to become a more standard of care procedure, although still in the United States, DNA mutation testing for GIST remains used in probably less than 10% of patients. And most of us see the future coming, and it is in the realm of personalized medicine. Dr. Heinrich will almost certainly talk about that towards the end of this conversation. But we believe that that is going to be a much more commonly used and standard procedure in the future. Now, why is the DNA even important? That comes back to what is GIST and why did it get on the radar screen in the first place? GIST got on the radar screen because it was a cancer that early on was identified as being dependent upon a specific type of mutation in the DNA that then led to production of an unusual protein. This protein called KIT is sort of like a light switch. If you turn the light switch on, electricity goes to the light bulb and it turns on. Well, usually KIT is carefully controlled so that the cells don't always have the electricity flowing through them, as it were, to just push that analogy to the limit. But in patients who, for whatever reason, develop a mutation in KIT, the light switch is mutated, it is locked in the on position, and the cell doesn't know how to shut off the signal, and that GIST cell now, which was supposed to be an ordinary cell, the ordinary cells that derive GISTs, actually are responsible for the movement of food through the stomach and through the GI tract in an automatic way, so you don't have to think about it. So they're interesting. They're a bit muscular, but they're also a bit nerve-like. So these cells are interesting cells to start with, but if they develop that mutation, they don't know how to stop growing. And that's the problem. They stick around, they accumulate, and they get in the way of the body, and then eventually they can develop the capability of spreading from beyond where they started into other parts of the body, either other parts of the abdomen or, God forbid, through the bloodstream and land in the liver or other places. So that metastatic problem of GIST is really why this disease is still occasionally a life-threatening disease. Now, the key thing here is that it is a mutation. So if there's a mutation and if that leads to an unusual protein, we should be able to shut it off. And that has been the story of the last 12 years of revolutionary research that Dr. Heinrich and I and others had the privilege of standing on the front row of developing the story of how you can shut off an abnormal protein and then help patients by doing that. Eventually, unfortunately, that protein can find a way around these targeted drugs like imatinib and like the second generation drug that is the only other drug approved worldwide for the treatment of GIST, and that is sunitinib or Sutent. Imatinib is also known by the trade name of Gleevec. Sunitinib is Sutent. After those drugs stop working, however, we remain in a very difficult position for patients who have widespread GIST. And that's the topic that Mike Heinrich will handle at the end of this discussion. What are some of the new things? So the bottom line here is that many patients, though, are still cured with surgery alone. And Dr. Wayne will talk about that. So I think it is a wonderful time for patients to be aware of the spectrum here. Many, perhaps more than 50% of patients will be cured just by surgery. The other patients can often have years of benefit ahead of them, even with just the current technology of these targeted therapies. And we hope that the research will continue to yield the kind of fruits of the harvest that we've already seen that gave rise to Gleevec and to Sutent. With that, we recognize also that more and more GIST patients are being treated in the community, not in research centers. And that's fine, because really it's easier to diagnose GIST now. Community pathologists are diagnosing it more accurately than ever, and community physicians know how to use Gleevec now with more than 10 years of experience, so that's quite simple. However, there still is the need for patients to be aware of why a research center might help them and why an academic expert center in their bigger geographic area might still be a reason to get a second opinion. There may be new drugs that one should try first and foremost, and there may be controversies over when the old drugs should be used or not used. And hopefully many of those things will come up in the next hour of our discussion. My job here was really just to give you a brief overview of GIST and some of the 30,000-foot up perspective. But now we're going to hand this over to Dr. Wayne to talk about surgery and surgical issues, and then Dr. Heinrich will talk about some of the new treatment issues, and at the end I'll come back and summarize some other elements.
Thank you very much, Dr. Dimitri. Outstanding and just wonderful overview and presentation for everybody to kind of really understand this all better. I thank you so much. And our next speaker is Dr. Jeffrey Wayne. Dr. Wayne is Associate Professor of Surgery, Chief Melanoma and Soft Tissue Surgical Oncology, Division of Gastrointestinal and Oncologic Surgery, Northwestern University Feinberg School of Medicine. He's also Associate Medical Director, Robert H. Lurie Cancer Center. Dr. Wayne is going to address the role of surgery in the treatment of GIST, including new treatment approaches, and the role of the pathology report. Dr. Wayne?
Thank you, Carolyn, and thank you, George, for providing a nice introduction and overview of the disease process. I couldn't agree more with George that being able to be involved with the ongoing trials and work in this disease has been incredibly gratifying. And this truly represents one of the successes of what we would call targeted therapy. But that being said, and the reason I guess I'm on this conference call with you all is because still in 2011, the surgery still remains the primary treatment for patients with localized or potentially resectable GI stromal tumors. Typically, the tumors that we are most concerned with are ones that are 2 centimeters or larger in size. However, any GIST can harbor malignant potential, and any patient with a GIST should be referred for either surgical or multidisciplinary evaluation to see if surgery is indicated, or whether, in the case of these very small GISTs or micro GISTs, whether occasionally observation might be entertained. And in our last iteration of the NCCN sarcoma and GI stromal tumor guidelines, we address this issue because certainly there are many people that have very small, very benign appearing GIST and may not require surgery and can potentially be followed. But that being said, I think for the majority of you on this conference call, you probably have had or have a family member who's had one of the more typical GIST, and GIST that again can harbor a very malignant course of behavior. But again, we'll talk a little bit more about that as we talk about surgery. I think the other thing to say as a surgeon is the first decision we have to make when we see a new patient with GIST is there any evidence of metastatic disease? Obviously, if there is metastatic disease, those patients are typically treated with one of the tyrosine kinase inhibitors up front, with surgery being potentially considered down the line, and we'll talk a little bit more about that later in this talk. If, again, we see a patient who does not have metastatic disease, the next thing we need to look at in our multidisciplinary evaluation of the patient is, can this surgery be done to remove the tumor with minimal morbidity and obviously, hopefully, no mortality? In other words, in this day and age of tyrosine kinase inhibitors, patients may be able to have a significant response to disease, and treating them in a neoadjuvant fashion, or in other words, treating them with a tyrosine kinase inhibitor before surgery or instead of surgery at the initial evaluation, may be favored. And there's definitely some subsets of patients in whom this is uniquely advantageous. Patients who have tumors in unusual locations, such as the rectum or the esophagus, or patients who have tumors in the duodenum near the outlet of the biliary tract and pancreas, who may require multivisceral radical resections. Those are patients who, again, George was mentioning, where might a university setting be advantageous to patients? Well, here's one case. If you don't have a medical oncologist or a surgeon who has treated a lot of patients with GI stromal tumors, here's a case where, you know, multidisciplinary evaluation is critical, because again, neoadjuvant therapy may be indicated in trying to spare the patient an ultra radical multivisceral resection, in other words, taking multiple organs, when again the patient can potentially be downstaged and undergo a relatively more straightforward operation. There are two trials that people often look at when they entertain neoadjuvant therapy. One was the Radiation Therapy Oncology Group trial 0132, which looked at imatinib both preoperatively and postoperatively in patients with potentially resectable GIST. And a small trial done at the MD Anderson Cancer Center, which looked at short courses of imatinib, again, ahead of a potentially curative resection for GIST, and then gave postoperative imatinib thereafter. So there is some basis for this to be done, and again, we certainly have had a very favorable experience in terms of being able to offer patients less morbid and less radical procedures where in the past they would have undergone really extensive multivisceral resection, which, it, again, in this day and age is typically reserved for patients with other sarcomas that may be not as responsive to medical therapy. Now, again, if you do go down this neoadjuvant approach, I think there's a couple things that, that need to be mentioned. Close monitoring of these patients is essential. In other words, the patient should always have a baseline MRI or CT scan. And we, the other thing to say is that we don't know the optimal duration of how long to treat patients in the neoadjuvant setting. And so these patients should be rescanned at some definitive intervals. We like to use 3 months. And surgical opinion should be gained at each of those reimaging sessions. And because it's often not necessary to necessarily wait till a maximal response is achieved or till there's progression achieved to look into to surgery. In other words, once we get to a point where we know we'll be able to do a smaller, easier surgery, then we can intervene at that point. Again, so close collaboration between the medical oncologist and the surgeon or surgical oncologist is crucial in those patients. And again, this all is taken in light of the fact that you have a patient who is basically has either an incidental or asymptomatic GIST or is not having really disabling symptoms or bleeding from their GI stromal tumor. In those cases, it may be necessary to entertain a more extensive surgery to palliate their symptoms earlier on. I think the other thing, and this neoadjuvant discussion leads us into the topic of laparoscopy and whether or not we can use a more minimally invasive approach in patients with GI stromal tumors. And I think while no large prospective series exist, certainly numerous retrospective series and small case-based series from multiple institutions, including our own, have examined this this issue. And what we know from looking at these series is that the laparoscopic approach may be considered in selected patients with GI stromal tumors with favorable locations, locations such as low on the greater curvature of the stomach, on the anterior wall of the stomach, lesions in the small bowel, especially the ileum and jejunum, tend to be very amenable to the laparoscopic approach or the laparoscopic assisted approach. And what we know is from these small series that these patients tend to have less postoperative pain, spend less time in the hospital, and the recurrence rates seem to be good with, you know, low in-hospital morbidity and postoperative morbidity. So again, this is something that can be brought up as you all act as advocates for yourself with your surgeon or your medical oncologist at the time of initial diagnosis. And what I basically would say there is the important thing is when you, if you are going to attempt a laparoscopic resection, that you need to follow the exact same principles in the laparoscopic procedure as you would if it was an open procedure. And I think just to go over those, these GI stromal tumors can be very friable. They need to be handled with care. We need to just resect them with a small amount of normal tissue, so a segmental or wedge resection is appropriate. We don't need to do wide lymphadenectomies. And resection, again, should be accomplished with minimal morbidity. And obviously, in the laparoscopic case, if there's any question about whether that can be done, the patient should be converted to an open procedure. I'm running out of time here, but just to quickly wrap up some other, I think, key surgical topics. Is there ever a role for surgery in patients with metastatic or unresectable disease or patients who have recurrent or progressive disease? The answer is a resounding maybe. Several studies have evaluated the impact of cytoreductive or what we would call in layman's terms debulking procedures in survival in patients with advanced GI stromal tumors treated with imatinib. And unfortunately, in 2011, we still don't have definitive data. In other words, no definitive trial has shown us that this approach improves clinical outcome in addition to simply continuing tyrosine kinase inhibitor therapy. And the good news is that there is at least one good prospective randomized phase 3 trial being conducted in Europe by the EORTC. That's protocol 62063, and that does look at this question, and so we may have answers to that question in the future. for progressive disease, if you have a patient who has limited disease progression, that may be a case where you have a different mutation within that clone of cells, and that may be another indication for a perhaps more limited surgery to remove that progressing area and then allow the patient to go back on their tyrosine kinase inhibitor therapy. I think just finally, to talk about the role of imatinib after surgery, or what we call adjuvant therapy, this has been approved by the FDA back in December of 2008 based on an American College of Surgeons phase 3 trial. However, there's lots of questions that could be asked, and maybe we'll get to some of those in the question and answer period about how long to continue that therapy and which patients might be most appropriate. In general, it'll be based on some risk stratification criteria, predominantly location of the tumor, size of the tumor, and number of mitoses per 50 high-powered fields that are seen by the pathologist. And so those are all very critical factors to make sure that that's in the pathology report. So, again, patients, I think, have been nicely made aware in this country that they need to be their own advocates. And so if you see a very limited pathology report or you're not sure that you're getting an opinion regarding whether laparoscopic surgery could be useful for you or whether surgery may be useful for you when you have metastatic disease, those are all things to bring up with your treating physicians. And, again, as George said, that might be the case. Those may be cases where, again, obtaining an opinion at least at a university setting might be most appropriate. So I think I've used up all my time, and I'll turn this back over to Carolyn. But, again, I'm happy to answer any questions as it relates to surgery and adjuvant therapy. And I think actually both Mike and George, you guys could both probably talk about all those issues also just as well when we get to the end.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Dr. Nguyen. And we definitely want you there for the Q&A because I know there will be questions for you, and excellent presentation. Thank you so much for covering a lot and a lot of complex material and making it very understandable for everyone. Thank you. Our next speaker is Dr. Michael Heinrich. Dr. Heinrich is professor of medicine and cell and developmental biology, hematology and medical oncology, Argonne Health and Science University. He's also section chief, hematology and medical oncology, Portland VAMC. And Dr. Heinrich is going to address new treatment approaches, the important role of clinical trials and how clinical trials contribute to treatment options, and new treatment options on the horizon. Dr. Heinrich?
Thanks, Carolyn. It's an absolute pleasure to participate in this call. One of the things that I've enjoyed in my practice of GIST patients is how well-educated they are and the tremendous role of the patient advocacy groups and online information, as well as opportunities such as this for patients to educate themselves, and I really enjoy when patients come to see me and they have their questions written down and they know the literature, and we can have a very in-depth discussion about their particular case and their particular concerns. Obviously, we've come a long way in the last 10 years. We've moved from the point that from a medical perspective, you know, prior to the year 2000, we had no therapy. Chemotherapy did not work for this disease. And so basically it was Dr. Wayne and his colleagues who were curing or treating these patients, and the medical oncologist had little to offer. That all changed with the application of imatinib or Gleevec to the treatment of GI stromal tumors. Now, why was this so successful? Well, this goes back to what Dr. Dimitri covered. In GI stromal tumors, most of the time there is an activating mutation of the KIT enzyme or related enzyme called platelet-derived growth factor receptor alpha, or PDGFRA. These rogue enzymes, which become excessively activated by mutation, are the targets for Gleevec or imatinib or Sutent or sunitinib, whatever you want to call them. And the reason the drugs work is because we're hitting the fundamental defect. Now, what we've observed in patients with advanced disease is that even though these therapies can be very effective, sometimes for years or sometimes even more than a decade, that in most patients over time, one or more of the tumors becomes resistant to the drug and starts growing again. We've had the opportunity over the last 10 years to analyze this, and what we found in most cases is that the reason the tumors become resistant is that the KIT protein has become mutated for a second time and becomes resistant. So borrowing a little bit off George's light switch analogy, I would say that imagine a light switch with a lockbox around it. And if we want to be able to turn off the light switch, we need to be able to open the lock. So the lock is the KIT protein, and the key is Gleevec, the drug we can use. When we start out in a patient, then all the locks are the same, so we can control all the light switches. Over time, different locks in different parts of your house become changed, and so the key doesn't work. But it's still the same problem. We have to open the lock. One way to get around that is to use a different key, and that's what we do when we use Sutent or other drugs. And the problem is that the locks can be changed in different ways, and not all the keys fit. And so some locks respond to one drug, some locks respond to another drug, but we can't find the key or a drug that works for everything. And that's sort of the biggest challenge in the field right now. The opportunity is that all of the keys that we have right now, all the drugs, are fairly similar. We are now developing, in collaboration with different drug companies and different research labs, different types of drugs that have different chemical structures. In a way, they're just a different type of key, but some of these are more like master keys, and they have the possibility that they could open all of the locks that have been discovered, or all of the secondary mutations in GI stromal tumor. So one of the ways that the field is changing is to do clinical studies of new drugs, and I'll come back to that in a minute. The other thing that's changing a lot in the field of GIST, although we're still trying to figure this out more completely, is that although most GISTs have mutations of KIT or PDGFRA, not all do, and about 10 to 15% of GISTs in adults do not have mutations. And we call these wild-type GISTs. We've observed, even back to the beginning, that patients with wild-type GIST don't have the same success rate with treatment that patients with KIT mutant GISTs. We're now trying to figure out what's going on. And in studies based mainly off pediatric GIST patients, we're now realizing that there are some other things that could go wrong, some other pathways that become mutated that can give rise to GI stromal tumor, and that wild-type GISTs are probably not just one type of GIST, but there are many types of GISTs. Interestingly, what we've learned is that some of the wild-type GISTs, what's wrong is very similar to what goes wrong in kidney cancer. And 10 years ago, that wouldn't have been too helpful because our treatment for kidney cancer wasn't very good. But over the last 10 years, five or six drugs for treatment of kidney cancer have been approved, and it may be going forward in the future that some patients with GIST would be treated more like a kidney cancer with different drugs that we never use in GI stromal tumor compared to what we currently do now. How are we going to get there? Well, that's clinical studies. And every drug that you've taken over the counter or that's prescription is all because of a clinical study. And there's different types that are called the phases of drug development. Phase one is when a drug is brand new, it's never been given to humans. And traditionally, this has been to figure out how toxic the drug is, what the dose should be, how much people can take without having side effects. In our new targeted era, phase one still looks like that, but in many cases, we actually expect the drug to work in phase one. Melanoma would be an example. And so phase one studies may not have completely a therapeutic intent, but these days they often do. Phase two studies are the most common type of study. This is a study where a drug has been studied enough to know how to safely give it, but we're not always sure who to give it to. So what disease or in GIST patients, which GIST patients would benefit from a drug. So the idea is to define a success rate that we think is interesting enough that we'd want to do further studies and see whether the drug meets the success rate. If the drug doesn't meet the success rate, then it usually gets dropped from further consideration. If the drug does meet the success rate, then it moves to phase three. And phase three is the type of study which usually is required for the FDA or regulatory agencies in other countries to approve a drug so that it can be prescribed. In these phase three studies, it's comparative. So you're taking treatment A, which is new, and you're comparing it to the standard treatment, treatment B. So in the case of high blood pressure, then, you know, you compare two blood pressure medicines and try to decide if one is better than the other or if they're both the same. In the case of GIST, as we get into more advanced disease, there is no standard of care, which raises the thorny issue of having placebo-controlled trials, which are not popular with patients or doctors, but are sometimes necessary in order to convince a regulatory agency like the FDA to approve a drug. And so I cannot emphasize how critical it is that patients participate in clinical studies when they're eligible and when it seems reasonable for their current medical condition. If people don't participate in clinical studies, we won't learn new things, we won't have new drugs, and we won't be able to advance care. And so particularly at academic centers, such as all the speakers here, we try to keep a portfolio of clinical studies of things that we think are important research questions open so that as we see patients who are in difficulty, we can offer them both conventional treatment or offer them new drugs or new treatment strategies to try to advance the field. In terms of advancing the field, just to conclude, you know, where I think that the field is going in the next 5 years are development of new drugs with new chemistries, some of these master keys that I described earlier. I think the other area that we're starting to explore but needs a lot more work is combination therapy. We know in the case of HIV that if you give one drug, it doesn't work. You have to give cocktails of drugs to conquer all of the wily resistance mechanisms of the virus. It's the same thing in cancer. In order to really control a disease for a really long time or ultimately to cure it, we need to block a lot of resistance pathways. That's going to require more than one drug, maybe two, maybe three, maybe four. But each time we combine a new drug, it becomes a new safety problem that we have to figure out if it's safe, and then we have to figure out it works. Hopefully, we'll learn how to do this more efficiently, and so we can move to combination therapy more rapidly than we have in the past. But to summarize, we've made a lot of progress in GI stromal tumor, and by understanding what's wrong and what can go wrong, I think that we can continue to make rapid progress.
I want to thank you very much, Dr. Heinrich. It's a really excellent presentation, very informative, and the concept of a key and lock, I think, is very helpful to everybody understanding the treatment, so that's really helpful, and I'm sure there'll be questions for you as well. And I'm going to ask Dr. Dimitri to come back, and Dr. Dimitri is going to address communicating with the healthcare team, quality of life concerns, including pain and symptom management. Dr. Dimitri?
So I just wanted to end up here by saying that for anybody who has any kind of a medical issue, it's very important to recognize how complicated medicine has gotten. And especially in diseases like GIST, where even when you hear us talk about it, GIST isn't one disease. It can be early, localized, easily curable, and even then, often decisions have to be made. Do you use the laparoscope, which is a special kind of a fiber optic thing to take it out, or do you do a big operation where the incision, the cut, is actually bigger? These decisions are relatively straightforward compared to the decisions that Dr. Heinrich was just talking about. There are many clinical trials. Which one might a patient wish to participate in? What are the risks? What are the benefits? And often our team, which has communicated extensively with lots of patients over the years, has learned as much from the patients as they've learned from us, because we've learned that often it's hard to communicate to healthcare professionals. We go to school for years and years and years to learn how to speak a different language than normal humans. And it's important to recognize when we're speaking that other language and to stop the doctor and say, excuse me, I really didn't understand what you just said. Could you say it a different way? And something as simple as that often will allow doctors to communicate more effectively with you, as well as bringing somebody from the family along when you go to key decision-making meetings with a doctor or a care team. Because very often when it's just the patient there, the patient may hear something, but then they're thinking about it, and meanwhile the doctor keeps talking. But they've missed that. That patient has missed that. And usually if there's two or three sets of ears in the room, it may help a lot. So these are simple, practical suggestions that I've actually learned mainly from our nurses who work with us, but also from interacting with some of the just outstanding patients in the GIST community who are some of the leaders in helping us to really approach medicine as a collaborative practice with the patients and with the families. Our aim as a global community is really to offer patients the best outcomes and also to focus on this issue of quality of life as we go along. We're not just looking at extending life. We are certainly looking to do that, but we also want to make sure that the quality of that life is as high as possible, and many of the treatment decisions that people go through can be framed in that question. I could go on to that trial, what's it like for me to participate? Or I could just take standard therapy, what's that like? These are ways of framing a question that are important for people. And especially as you think about different kinds of clinical trials, it's very relevant to talk about that. And the last thing is that many of the drugs we deal with are outstandingly good compared to the side effects of old conventional chemotherapy. But like every drug, from aspirin to Prilosec to Viagra, anything has some side effects. Everything has some risks involved. So it's also important always to know as much as you can about what are the risks of a standard drug, what should I expect, because if you're talking to your doctor, your nurse, or your nurse practitioner about these, you will be better prepared to handle whatever kinds of side effects might be there and to expect them, and that'll give you the best shot at staying on the drug in the most helpful and least risky way possible. And also give your doctor and your nurse practitioner a chance to manage any kind of symptoms, which may be something like a rash, or it may be something like heartburn, or it may be something like multiple loose stools during the day that may be associated with the study drug or a standard drug. It's important just to have that line of communication open with people, and the doctors and the nurses probably know about these things, but you may not. So it's important to ask about what are the possible side effects, and then if you're having any side effects, raise that to your care team. And I would lastly just emphasize that this isn't just about doctors. I would say that so much of the expert medical care that our group, and I know Dr. Wayne's group and Dr. Heinrich's group give, is delivered through nurses and physician's assistants and nurse practitioners, all of whom make up the teams that we are so proud of working with at our expert centers, and that really are very dedicated to offering the best for GIST patients everywhere. So with that, rather than us take all the time as monologues, we envision this a little bit more interactively. So, Carolyn, I think we had some time for questions still.
Well, yes, we do. Thank you very much, Dr. Dimitri. And we now do have time for questions. We have lots of time for questions. I'm going to ask Mary to explain to all of you how to queue up for questions, and we're going to try to take as many of your questions as possible. If we do not get to your question, please call us at the end of the call at 1-800-813-HOPE, and we will take your questions at that point. Mary?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star then one on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, we press the pound key. Again, if you do have a question, please press star then one on your touch-tone telephone. Our first question comes from Catherine M.
If you've had a GIST in the past, is there a greater chance of reoccurrence? And connected with that, how can a GIST be avoided in the future?
Dr. Dimitri, would you like to take that?
Well, I'll take part of that. Yeah, the key element here is that just like Dr. Wayne was alluding to, there are ways of grading the risk of a GIST from the past. For example, if the GIST were 30 inches big when it got taken out, it may be particularly at high risk of coming back just because it was so big. Now, that's a simple-minded way of looking at it, and in fact, not all big GISTs are particularly risky to come back. Some big GISTs, if they didn't have a lot of growing cells inside them, and the doctors can report that on the pathology report in a peculiar section that's talking about mitoses. Mitoses are pictures of cells, basically when we catch them when they're making a carbon copy of each other. And if a tumor has a lot of mitoses, it's making a lot of carbon copies of each other, so it's presumably growing fast. So a little tumor with a lot of mitoses is actually more risky to be potential for coming back than a big tumor with very few mitoses. these are the kinds of things that factor into the risk profiling of a GIST from the past. So the overall answer is, if you ever had a GIST, are you more likely to have it come back in the future than somebody who never had a GIST? And the answer is yes. But it's not necessarily a big risk. It depends on those specifics of the first tumor and what the risk profiling of the first GIST was. And then your second question was, well, how can we prevent GIST from the first place? And the truth is, none of us on the phone nor anybody else in the world knows the answer to that. We don't know what causes GIST. We don't know how to prevent it. And thank goodness, it's still relatively rare. But that's the truth. And I don't know if Mike or Jeff have any other questions about that, pieces about that piece.
I mean, I guess, you know, George, I think maybe the answer also to this question is, you know, there is a role for adjuvant therapy in this disease, and we certainly have shown that we can decrease increase the recurrence-free interval, and while we haven't been able to show that we've been able to improve ultimately survival in any of the trials to date, we do believe that keeping someone from developing metastatic disease may prevent them from ever having metastatic disease, if you will, and may improve their survival overall from the disease. So I think, we like to talk about multidisciplinary management of these patients and these tumors, and I think this is another critical piece of the puzzle. When you have when you've been diagnosed with a very rare tumor, that's when you need really some high level thought and into, should I be am I the type of patient that you know can just be cured with, you know, a surgery with some likelihood, or should I consider taking imatinib, even though, you know, the surgery was done appropriately, there was no other disease visible by the naked eye and by imaging studies. Would, you know, taking imatinib in the postoperative period help me and ultimately decrease my chances of this tumor coming back?
And let me make one other comment. This is George Dimitri again. I actually think here's where we can all put a tip of the hat to the European FDA. The European FDA people, when they approved imatinib as a prevention of recurrent GIST, they specifically said it's really only approved for people who are at significant risk of having the disease come back. And they recognize that if you've got a very low chance of having the disease come back, you shouldn't take imatinib. There's no real reason to have the cost and the side effects of any drug if your chance of it coming back is quite low. And the point at which significant becomes significant is a matter of discussion between you and your doctor, but at least they put that phraseology in there. The FDA simply said imatinib is approved for use in the adjuvant setting after the first surgery, and they gave no more advice or direction to doctors nor patients. So I actually think the European wording is much preferable in that regard, because it does bring up just what Dr. Wayne was saying. It's a spectrum.
Excellent. And here for everyone, as you've seen during the first half hour of the program, but even now, so you see all of our speakers, that multidisciplinary team really addressing and how they work together to address a question or an issue as you bring it up. So here it is, the team in action. Thank you. Our next question, please.
Our next question comes from Loretta Kay.
Yes, hi. I had a stromal tumor removed in 2004. And now in 2010, I had stage 3 papillary carcinoma, so I had my thyroid removed. So I'm just wondering, is there any connection here?
Excellent question.
Can I take that one? Can
yeah,
I take
George?
Yeah, if you don't mind, Mike, you could have, Michael could have taken it too, but we have a study for you, Loretta, that you can actually go online called www.projectflag.org. projectflag.org, nonprofit, stands for Project Families Learning About GIST, funded by the National Cancer Institute. We're working with Oregon and Fox Chase and Memorial Sloan Kettering and MD Anderson, and basically we're asking that very question. Are there other diseases that track with GIST, like brain tumors or thyroid cancers or leukemias or breast cancer or anything? And we're really trying to get a sense of just that question. Certainly in some of the children with GIST, there are well-known other cancers that can go along with it, like non-functioning paragangliomas, these multisyllabic terms that are meaningless to most people. But there are these unusual diseases that can go along with GIST in kids. We're wondering, as a global community, are there also other cancers like thyroid cancer that might be commoner in GIST patients than not? We don't know the answer to that. We're about halfway there. There is no charge for this. You don't have to do anything special. There's a website that gives you all the information. And we are basically encouraging all the GIST patients. Frankly, if all 589 people on the call right now knew somebody with GIST and they signed up, the study would be over. We're looking for 600 people. We're about halfway there.
Okay, so we have our work cut out for us. This is a call to action. And thank you so much, Loretta, for your question, and that's a wonderful answer. Thank you.
Well, I didn't answer her question entirely. The answer is we don't know. Mike, I don't know. Are there any connections between papillary thyroid cancer and GIST from a molecular standpoint that you know of?
Not that we know of. Thyroid cancer is, you know, more common than GIST, so could be just two rare events happening in the same person.
Yeah, I would probably agree with that, but it does bring up the issue of, you know, monitoring thyroid hormone levels during treatment with imatinib, and maybe that's where some of the confusion comes in.
That's an interesting question. It often does come up, the issue of really, you're talking about really a second cancer. How often does that happen, or how frequent is that?
It's getting more common because just patients are living longer than ever before, and cancer of any kind is a disease of aging. And so that's an issue. If we see a man who's been 10 years on Gleevec and now he's got a prostate cancer, maybe he was just destined to have that prostate cancer and he's been lucky enough to live the last decade to develop that. And again, not all prostate cancers are even worth treating. That's one of the big things. There are common cancers that can be very slow-moving and may never bother somebody. So we simply don't know, and in many ways that was the basis for this Project Flag. That's why we need 600 to 1,000 people to basically assess, are we seeing more other kinds of unusual cancers in GIST patients than you would expect just by the routine distribution of cancers in the population?
Awesome. Thank you. We have a question that has come up. How much disagreement is there among physicians for patients with GIST following surgery in terms of using adjuvant treatment? We've touched on that, but if we can just address that a bit more. Dr. Heinrich or Dr. Dimitri? Dr. Wayne?
Well, it's Dr. Heinrich. I would say that there's a fair amount of controversy. So what we know is that taking Gleevec for 1 year after surgery for GIST, primary GIST, decreases your chance of the tumor coming back in the short run. What we don't know is whether that means we've decreased the chance of coming back in the long run. And obviously that's the important point. If we thought that we were, or we knew that we were curing people, then we would certainly do it more routinely. If we just thought that we were delaying something that's going to happen anyway or not happen, then that would be more controversial about who should take it or when you should take it. The other, I think, big areas of controversy, and then Dr. Dimitri and Dr. Wayne kind of touched on this, is how much risk is too much risk to let go unchecked? And so if you have a 2% risk of the tumor coming back, should you take Gleevec? Most people would say no, but what if it's 10% or 15 or 20 or 50? Obviously, if it was 90%, then everybody would say would treat. So at the high end, everybody would treat. At the low end, everybody would not treat. But where's the happy middle where we should be treating people? And I think the final area of controversy, which reflects our lack of knowledge, is that many people believe, and trials are ongoing to determine whether taking it for Gleevec for more than a year after surgery is better than taking it only for a year. So there's an ongoing trial of 1 versus 3 or 0 versus 2. There's trials of 5 years. But one thing that may come down is that Gleevec helps after surgery, but only if you keep taking it. And that gets into a whole complicated sphere of thinking about, you know, in a 40-year-old who has a high risk of recurrence who can keep it at bay by taking Gleevec for the rest of their life, you know, should we do that, or would it be better to hope that they're cured by surgery and treat them if the tumor comes back? And certainly Dr. Wayne and Dr. Dimitri can expound on these areas.
Well, I'll jump in just for 1 second and just to say, and George will see, and Mike, see if you agree. I mean, I think the pendulum has swung. Early on, while those trials were ongoing, we certainly encouraged people not to take adjuvant Gleevec until we had some results from the trial. Once the results came back, I think it kind of opened the floodgates, and I think this is what George was getting at a little bit when he talked about the European FDA specifying that the patient should be at risk. I think once the approval came, I think there was a move by a lot of practitioners to simply put any patient who had a GIST resected on Gleevec. Interestingly, we did present some data at the GI ASCO symposium a couple of weeks ago in San Francisco, tracking the use of adjuvant therapy in GI stromal tumor in the National Cancer Database, which is a national repository of tumor data from institutions throughout the country, and you could definitely see that there was a rise in the use of adjuvant therapy that occurred well ahead of the approval of this drug by the FDA. And so I think it just confirmed something that we knew at the academic centers. In other words, patients were getting this drug. If they wanted this drug and they knew they wanted the drug, they weren't going to enter the trial. They were going to go to an oncologist that would give it to them. And so I think you just have to, again, get back to the risk stratification issue. And I think you need to sit down with your physician after you've had your surgery and say, you know, okay, what might my risk be? And the answer is we don't have, you know, obviously ultimate data. We do have some data. There's a paper by Mietnin and Lasota that looked at size, mitotic rate, and location of the tumor. In other words, if you have a tumor in an unusual location, your risk may be high even with a small tumor. George mentioned a 30-centimeter tumor. Well, you could have a 2 or 3 centimeter tumor in the rectum or the terminal ileum that might have just as high a risk of recurrence or higher if it had more mitosis. So again, this is an important thing to talk about your physician with, and if your physician isn't well versed in those statistics and hasn't treated a lot of patients in that setting, again, that's where at least an initial consultation at a sarcoma center is certainly warranted, and then, you know, perhaps getting your treatment closer to home would be easiest. But, you know, again, this is the crucial decision, and you know, I've had patients come back to me 1 year after their surgery and ask about adjuvant therapy. Well, at that point, they've kind of put themselves into the observation group. So this is something we want to, you know, decide, you know, in the immediate post-surgical period, and, you know, maybe not while your staples or sutures are still in, but, you know, once you've recovered from surgery.
And the last thing I would say is, and I agree with everything that's just been said, this is not that much different than virtually everything else in medicine. There are a choice of treatments in breast cancer. There are a choice of treatments in even how to fix a hernia. So, you know, medicine's all about options. And I think to have a doctor who's comfortable discussing with you what the options are and often saying, gee, you've only seen one of these in your professional career, it might be reassuring if I talk to somebody who's seen 20 or 30 or 1,000. So that's the other unusual thing about GIST, is that the expertise does seem to be concentrated in various academic centers, but we recognize that doctors in the community are increasingly seeing GIST patients now. And at what point does a patient say, look, doctor, I love you and I trust you, but I really would like to see somebody who's seen more than 2 or 3 of these?
So I'll tell you, George, I never would ever, you know, dissuade a patient from seeking a second opinion. And what I usually tell my patients are, if they would like a second opinion, you know, we've certainly told people with metastatic or locally advanced GIST that we wouldn't do a surgery when they've had someone else tell them that they would do surgery. And what I usually tell those patients is, listen, I'd love for you to get a second opinion. I encourage you to get a second opinion. But let me give you, you know, a list of names or people who really are experts in this disease, and let me direct you to them, because, again, this is a complex and rare tumor. And so, again, even from the university setting, I will never take offense to a patient telling me they want a second opinion. They have to be comfortable with the treatment to choice themselves.
Well, the same thing here. When my patients say, Dr. Dimitri, I've heard your name, but I hear you're an opinionated son of a gun, I'd really rather go see somebody else, too. I encourage that because I think the more information people start with, the better. So I think any doctor who's comfortable in his or her own skin should encourage second or third opinions. That's fine.
So here we're saying that these are our world's experts, and they're saying to you, all of you in the audience, that you can seek a second opinion when you're seeing them as well as your community-based physician. That's an important, very important takeaway, because I know people often have a very hard time with asking their physician about seeking a second opinion and wanting to get their record so that they can seek a second opinion. So I think there's a consensus amongst our presenters here that this is really a good thing to do very often.
But one thing I might add to all this that kind of goes back to the importance of communication is that, as George said, oftentimes there is more than one choice that could be given or more than one treatment that could be used. And sometimes the important thing is not what the doctor thinks knowledge-wise. The important thing is what the patient thinks is best for them, because all of the options are of equal value, but the patient is the one that has to decide what fits in with their life and their goals and their symptoms.
That's a really good point, Mike. I'll give you one real-world example here. The current study, as I understand, there's at this point only one phase 3 trial for GIST in the country, in the United States right now, and that's this new drug called regorafenib, which structurally looks somewhat like sorafenib. It's also used to be called fluorosorafenib because it has a fluorine knocked onto it. Now, sorafenib is FDA approved for kidney cancer and liver cancer and can be purchased at virtually any pharmacy in the country. And we all believe that sorafenib also has some activity in GIST, although it doesn't carry an FDA license to be used in GIST. Not license, but an FDA indication. In other words, it hasn't been through the FDA process, and very often insurance companies will say, well, if it's not through the FDA, we won't pay for it. Regorafenib has activity. Dr. Heinrich has been collaborating with my colleague here, Dr. Suzanne George and Meg von Marin at Fox Chase, to show that regorafenib has enough activity to justify eventually going to the FDA, but we're doing a big phase 3 trial to prove that it has enough activity for the FDA to bestow upon it a formal indication. And if it is true, in about a year, we would go to the FDA and say, okay, could you please make this the third approved drug for GIST? Because right now there's only two, imatinib and sunitinib, and we're hoping to make this the third. With that having been said, I think any reasonable doctor would have a conversation with a patient who is no longer benefiting from imatinib or sunitinib to say, well, we have this trial, regorafenib. It is a research trial. There are certain good things about participating in a research trial. There are certain bad things and inconveniences. And we could potentially argue with your insurance company and see if they would pay for sorafenib, which may have similar activity. We simply don't know. But that's the kind of discussion that our team has with patients. You know, and I think that's the kind of discussion anybody would want. You want to know what your options are. You want to know the pros and the cons. And I think it's a reasonable conversation that people are aware of clinical research options but never feel pressured into them, because, you know, that's the whole idea of research. Anybody is thinking about being in a clinical research study, it's a volunteer activity. It's your choice always.
Well, I want to thank you all. You have been just an outstanding call, just remarkable call. I want to thank all of you for your presentations. I want to thank all of you who've asked excellent questions and all of you who've been listening as well. I do want to remind you that this is a one-hour workshop. However, I also want to let you know that although the workshop will end very soon, your access to services does not end. That is continuous. And I want to say a word about cancer care, but I also want to encourage you to access all of the organizations that are listed as resources for you, and particularly many of the GIST organizations that are really so prominent in this area that could be so helpful to you. Cancer Care is an organization that provides free support services to people living with cancer. We have a staff of 60 master's level trained oncology social workers, and we're here to provide practical and financial assistance. We also offer counseling, a fancy word for someone to talk to in a systematic way to help you with your concerns. We offer support groups on the telephone and online. We have many of these workshop programs, and you have a calendar of information about all those programs we have coming up and more that are being planned, and more with your suggestions will be even other ones as well. And we have many publications and fact sheets as well. So to some extent, we offer quite a few services, and we do encourage you to take advantage of them. They are free to access. And all of the organizations that are listed, all of the many collaborating organizations and the GIST organizations, all offer services that are free and that are wonderful for you to contact as well. Most importantly, as we conclude our program today, I would not want anyone to feel that you are alone in coping with GIST or with cancer. I want you to know that you're part of a community of support, and we are all just a telephone call or an email away, really, a mouse click or a telephone call away. And you can contact Cancer Care by calling 1-800-813-HOPE or visiting our website at www.cancercare.org. But most importantly, often people with cancer can feel alone. We want you to know that when you are feeling alone or when you feel like you've got a problem that you can't solve, call Cancer Care. Our staff should be able to be of help to you. I want to thank you all for participating today. I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may disconnect and have a wonderful day.